Welcome to tonight's broadcast of All Things Cage. You're listening to Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM radio for open ears. At this point, I usually say I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, longtime director of the John Cage Trust, and then introduce this week's guest. But tonight we have a turn of the tables, so to speak. As a previous guest, the international recording, touring, guitar virtuoso Aaron Lerger-Kaplan, who appeared with me on All Things Cage on January 9th, has requested that he take the lead on a conversation with me. So more appropriately, I should introduce this week's program by saying Aaron Lerger-Kaplan is your host, and his guest this week is Laura Kuhn, longtime director of the John Cage Trust.
Hello.
Hi, Aaron. How are you?
I'm very well, Laura. It's wonderful to see you again online. I guess that's where we are, and to be able to hear your voice and have this exchange.
Thank you very much. I've missed you. It feels like weeks since we've spoken.
It has been a couple. I do think it's been a couple, and I've heard some wonderful things about All Things Cage. I very much enjoyed our last conversation and can't wait to go through this kind of changing of positions, I guess.
Great.
You'd say.
I've told our listening audience that this is a quid pro quo.
Well, I need to learn more about you. There's so much about John Cage, about how you get to where you are, what are you, where are you, all of these things. It's just life is too short to just not get an idea of some of these answers, if not the answer.
What do you want to know?
Well, let's see. So you're, of course, the director of the John Cage Trust. But before, who? Like, where are you from? What instruments or instrument did you play? And how does one find yourself in the John Cage Trust director seat?
It's all a fairly simple story. I was born in San Francisco, which is where I grew up. I'm one of many, many children. I was always interested in music, even as a youngster. I didn't have any musical training as a kid. My father was a pianist. My grandmother was a singer. But my father felt that really music was a luxury, that you really should learn how to type, or you should learn how to, you know, have some marketable skills in your life. Mm-hmm. So it really wasn't until I did a lot of things as a kid, you know, talent show kinds of things, that kind of silliness. I would produce things. I would listen to, you know, pop records, and I would transpose the parts. I would figure out all the different parts, and then a quartet in high school would sing them, you know.
Oh, interesting.
Like, more like Mamas and Papas, or I can't think of anything else right now. Had I known you were going to ask this question, I would have made it. But I enjoyed that a lot. And so, but it wasn't until I went to college as, you know, as a normal college aged person that I actually started to study music. And I studied music. And it was at that point that I took up piano. I studied piano for a long time, but I was primarily a singer for most of the time that I was performing. And I took up classical guitar, believe it or not. I just bring that up for you.
It's because you have great taste. It's just, that's how it
you
works.
You know, the fact of the matter is that I wanted to, I had played piano and sang, but I wanted an instrument which was, I thought in my head, that it would be something that was an integrative instrument for me physically. That by employing the left hand and the right hand and cradling an instrument against me, that it would have some sort of, it would have an effect, or it would have a tone or a feeling in my playing of it that I didn't experience as a singer or as a pianist.
Interesting. Well, it's true that there's no, we talk about this often, I talk about it with my students, that there's nothing between me and the string in when I play guitar, and the vibrations, I can tune my guitar, I can tell when it's out of tune by how it vibrates on my chest. Whereas a piano, you have the hammer, the pedals, the keys, all these things between you and the creation, which makes it very individual, but there's nothing more natural than singing. So it's interesting that you were looking for another aspect of it.
Yeah, I think there was this idea that I had about stopping the stringer that is creating the tone with my left hand and then bringing it to life with my right. There was something very circular in feeling about that for me. And I went to the local, I was living in Marin County in California, and I went to the local instrument shop. And there was this very handsome, very helpful young man who sold me two guitars, not one, but two. He sold me a nylon string guitar and a steel string guitar, because when he asked me which I wanted to play, I had no idea. So he sold me one of each. And then I said, do you know of a teacher? And he said, well, I'm a teacher. And I said, great, so you could be my teacher. And he said, no, no, I have other thoughts for you. And he asked me out.
Well, that's so guitar. That is just so guitar. I'm sorry.
We were partners for, I don't know how many years, a number of years. And I studied, however, with his teacher, Jan Luce. I don't know if you know this name. Oh, I still have her exercise sheets and things like that. She was
awesome.
And she sold me a guitar that she had learned on, a Manouk Papazian guitar.
Oh, Papazian. Yeah.
Those are, I still have.
Those are beautiful, beautiful instruments.
Exactly.
Oh, good.
And I felt very, very fortunate. It was a guitar that had a very narrow neck.
Right.
And I don't know if that was unique to all of his guitars or if he just made that.
He did some variations, smaller bodies. He would do, it was almost like custom, it felt. Because I know I've played three or four and each of them are completely different.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, this had a very narrow neck and she thought it would be good because my hands are not very big. Even as a pianist, I had trouble. You know, I could barely do octaves. So I was having to roll things a lot on the piano. But the guitar was perfect for me because the neck was so narrow. Anyway, I studied, you know, I never achieved greatness.
At that moment, it's okay. We're still working on it. Aren't we all?
I haven't played my guitar in so long, I'm embarrassed to say.
Once a guitarist, always a guitarist.
Yeah, but I enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed it a lot. There's something really, really challenging about a guitar. It's different than a piano. You know, the piano is, the instrument is in place. Do you know what I mean?
That
you can get different kinds of tone from the instrument, but you're not creating the capability of the instrument. You know, it has, that's built in.
I think the aspect of the piano where everything's proportional, you know, if you want to play a major triad, you have a couple variations, but the spacing is always the same. And on the guitar, it just laughs at you. It's like, oh, you like that chord? You can't do it a half step higher or lower. You know, this is the place. But I tell people there's four middle C's on the guitar, and that's without harmonics. And so each one has such a different quality to it that it's really almost, when playing a piece, it's almost like a choreography more than just reading the notes.
Yeah. And that's, you know, because the piano, you can really only play things one way. You know, you want to play that particular note.
That's
you
it.
Play that anywhere else. So it just felt very fixed. The piano felt very fixed to me. So that's it.
That's it. So then how do you go from, you know, being raised with, in essence, pop music or just a general upbringing to going to college? You're singing, you're playing, you trip down the wonderful hole of the guitar to finding the music of John Cage. When did you first hear it? Was it on television? There's a big gap here. We need to fill this gap.
Okay, fine. So I went to College of Marin very shortly after Robin Williams graduated from College of Marin's theater program. It was a wonderful school, little community college in California. We don't think of community colleges as being particularly good, but this was absolutely marvelous. It was just a great place to cut my really naive teeth in a music program. Once I graduated from there, I went on to college at Dominican College and studied really, that was where I developed a love of contemporary music. My thesis was on the unlikely hero. So Wozzeck, you know, really characters in operas who were unlikely heroes, very much like Mad Men now, Sopranos now, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then I went on to graduate school. I took off a couple of years and worked as a music critic for a
the Independent Journal, which was a Gannett publication in mm-hmm. California. And then I decided to go back to go to graduate school, mostly because I wanted to read more. I wanted to study more. So I ended up at UCLA, entered a program in what's known as systematic musicology, which is pretty much unknown to even most musicologists. It's a branch of musicology that really emanated out of Europe. And it has to do with looking at musical objects or phenomena through many windows. So in order to be a systematic musicologist, you might study, let's just take anything. You want to study the music of Chopin. You would study it from a theoretical point of view. You might study it from a historical point of view, a biographical point of view, any point of view that you can think of. And I enjoyed that very much because as an academic program, it allowed me to take classes across a really wonderful campus. So I could take film classes, I could take dance classes, I could take literature classes, I could take anything. And that would fulfill the requirements of a systematic musicology degree. They no longer teach this program, by the way. It ended just as I left.
That's too bad. It sounds very interesting. It sounds like a wide-ranging program, which is not typically a graduate program. Graduate programs are so focused.
Interesting. Because that was the draw, that it wasn't this really, kind of preordained program that I was going to fit into. Because my interests were great. I was dancing a lot. I was a ballerina. Mm. And so I was doing a lot of dancing. One of my best friends was a film composer by the name of David Raxson, who, by the way, wrote the song Laura.
There you go.
This is how we met.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So I knew a lot of, I had a lot of interests. So systematic musicology allowed me to kind of bring all those things together.
And then you found Cage at school?
Or? When I was in graduate school. So as it was toward the end of my master's degree, which I did on a comparative study of Eisenstein's montage film theory and Wagner's idea of the Gesamtkunstwerk.
Nice small topics. Exactly. Yes.
But that was my master's degree. And I hadn't actually quite decided what I would do for a doctoral dissertation. So I wasn't positive about that. And that's when I heard Cage's music for the first time. Now, I certainly knew who he was.
Right.
And I had heard things like, I had heard live, you're in graduate school, you go to concerts all the time on the campus. Right. So a lot of prepared piano things I had heard, some of the string pieces I had heard, but that was about it. Everybody around me, I worked with the musicologist Nicholas Slonimsky.
Oh, yes.
When I was in graduate school. And so I worked with him really throughout my master's program. And he also was a person who thought that enough had been written about, forget Stravinsky, forget Schoenberg. Right. These were all people who had plenty of people around the world writing about them. So that had some effect on me. But it was really, I have to tell you, I lived in the west side of Los Angeles, going to UCLA, but there was this concert that was going to take place at CalArts, which was up the 405 freeway. I got a late start and traffic was terrible, as it always is in Los Angeles. And I drove up there and I was late when I arrived at the concert hall at CalArts. And I went running in and I was out of breath and I walked in and there were all these people standing around and I thought, oh my God, they haven't even started their rehearsing. Well, you're laughing because you get the punchline.
Yeah.
The punchline was, it was lecture on the weather and the performers were all sort of standing on soap boxes, so to speak, performing. They were reading texts. The weather sounds were happening and children were running around and people were walking around and people were talking. And I thought it hadn't started. And then I realized it had absolutely started. And I thought it was really one of the most exciting things I had ever attended.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah.
I like how those, oh my gosh, I'm going to miss, what's going to happen? Oh, and then you walk into this other world. And I think that experience, I think a lot of people have that with Cage, where you come expecting something, this very strict concert experience. and you have something else. I was at the Gardner Museum up in Boston last 2019, February 2019, so 2 years ago about. Robert Wilson did Lecture on Nothing, and I had read it, you know, in silence. I had, you know, heard excerpts of it, but I had never experienced it, and he did it as performance art.
Right. And I saw him do it in London.
It was amazing. And yeah. But I mean, the Gardner Museum is this very small stage. It may be 40 feet across a square, and it has one row of seats. And then there's a second level, which also has one row of seats, but a glass barrier so you can look down, a third and a fourth level. And that's it. So you have no one sitting behind you, no one in front of you, just the glass, and you're looking down. And they did it, and it was just fantastic. And I remember walking out of there just, some people were completely confused. What did we just see? And I was just, what happened? I'm so excited by not knowing what just happened. And all I must have thought about that. I still think about it. And I think that's happening is, yeah, that's wonderful. So
it was not even in the theater. It was in the foyer. And I just remember running around all these different positions in this foyer, up some stairs, watching from above, getting really close to the performers, looking at the scores while they were reading, you know. And I just thought, this is fantastic. You said something in my interview with you where you were talking about, so you made some comment like people think about Cage as being this kind of extremist, this a lot of noise, a lot of, but this was not that at all,
right,
despite the simultaneity of voices. It was actually incredibly beautiful and luscious. Mm-hmm. You know, it had this very rich sort of unfolding. I don't know, I just thought it was amazing. And I got really excited about him.
And so that led you to write and to study his music or to sing? No.
No, not at all. What happened was right around that time, I applied for a grant to study in New York for a semester. Mm-hmm. And I applied. It was that they nicknamed this grant like going to New York and live like a queen grant.
Oh, wow.
Because it was not a long grant, but it was very, it was, they gave you enough money to live well.
And you could actually enjoy New York.
You could go to theater stuff. They didn't. They wanted you to take in the city. They really wanted you to take in the city. And interestingly, the premise, or if you will, or my proposal that got me the grant was that I wanted to study what we used to call intermedia art. This was in the mid-80s. And obviously now everything's intermedia.
Right.
But back then that was quite novel. There were Ping Chong and Meredith Monk. So I ended up working with Robert Wilson. I got the grant. I know, it's very funny, isn't it? It's a small world. Anyway, I got the grant. Interestingly, the Cage and Cunningham were not on my list of people that I wanted to look at. But the primary draw was Robert Wilson and Heiner Müller, who were doing Hamlet Machine. That dates the story a little bit. So I got to just really hang out with Robert Wilson during the production of Hamlet Machine. This was at NYU. And then I went on to do a lot of research at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. That was its heyday with the Next Wave festivals. Mm-hmm. They had footage of just everything that they had been presenting. Still no Cage, still nowhere near Cage. But one of my closest friends, who, by the way, is a really close friend of Ned Roram's, we were talking about Roram, Pia Gilbert, was kind of the mother hen of me and one other person who had gotten this grant. And she had recently become emeritus at UCLA and moved to New York. And she was now teaching at Juilliard. It was Pia who said, this is what she sounded like. I swear, this is exactly what she sounded like. Laura, it's so good to see you, Laura. She sounded just like that. But Pia, we were talking as we did like once a week, she's checking up on me. And I had finished what I had set out to do and I still had about a month. And she said, you know, what do you want to do? And I said, I'm not sure. And she said, would you be willing to help John Cage? He's a very good friend and I've talked to him today and he's really down. He's embarked on an opera for Frankfurt and he doesn't know how he's going to finish it in time. And I said, God, I would love it.
And she said, all right, I'll tell him. And I was living with Nicholas Slonimsky's daughter on Waverly Place and Sixth Avenue. Her name is Electra. And yes,
Electra. That's just so perfect for him.
So Nicholas, I know. Yeah. But anyway, and Cage and Cunningham lived up on Sixth Avenue and 18th Street. So we were about a mile apart, if even that. And I remember running off to Belducci's after I talked to Pia. Belducci's was right up the street. And I came back, couldn't have been a half hour later. My partner who was staying with us at the time said, oh, John Cage called. And I said, yeah, very funny. Ha ha ha. But it turned out John Cage had called.
That's awesome.
And, yeah. And he had invited me he was very appreciative that I was willing to talk about helping. And he invited me over the next morning. And I went over to his loft. I walked up the next morning. The window washer was coming that day. So the job first thing in the morning was take some 300 plants that were on windowsills or on the floor in front of windows and move them away from the windows. So I helped him do that. And we got to know each other. And really, the rest is history. You know, I began to work with him and in New York. And then when I went back to Los Angeles, we had my work with him initially was entirely focused on the Your Operas 1 and 2, which was his first full-scale opera for Frankfurt. And I very quickly decided that I would do a doctoral dissertation on Your Operas 1 and 2, because I knew it inside and out, which is what I did. And I went back to UCLA, but Cage gave me jobs to do when I was in LA. So we would talk all the time. And he never really got, he had one very quick relationship with another assistant, but that didn't work out real well. And so I ended up going there every couple of months and spending a week or two with Electra and walking up to Cage Cunningham's loft every day and working with him.
With your dance background, did you have a connection with Cunningham, or was it just a completely, that wasn't part of this at all?
You would think so, wouldn't you?
And well, you mentioned it and I never thought of it. And then I know that you've done so much that it would, maybe it came up. I have no idea.
Yeah, it's funny that you should ask, because it never did. You know, the distance between ballet and modern dance study is great, number one. So it never dawned on me to approach Cunningham, but I did finally. I think it was after John died. And I approached Cunningham and I said, you know, maybe I could take Cunningham classes at the studio. And he said, oh, yes. So I signed up, having studied ballet for years.
Right.
I signed up for, I don't know, maybe the advanced beginner class at Cunningham. And I remember taking the class. I don't remember the teacher. She was a beautiful Asian woman, I think, who had danced with Martha Graham. God, her name is just nowhere near the front of my head.
Did you have to like unlearn everything?
No, but I will tell you. I mean, but this the end of the story will tell you how this went. I'm in this class and I'm feeling very proud, you know, because I take ballet and I'm really strong and I can, you know, and I get to the end of this class and this teacher comes up to me and she says, oh, it's very nice to meet you. You are a friend of Cunningham. And I said, yes, I am. And she said, you have such a beautiful back. And I said, full of pride, thank you. And she said, it's a pity you never use it.
Oy! Oh, ouch, ouch. Interesting. Yeah. Wow.
So it isn't so much you have to unlearn things, but it's a different animal. You know, it's just a totally different animal.
Oh, I mean, we get it in guitar as a classical guitarist. I'll meet someone and they're like, well, can you play this? And I'm like, well, the blues are completely different. Jazz is completely different. And yes, there are stylistic things that I can do, but I'd have to study jazz. There's people you should go hire who are much better than me.
Exactly.
Who devote to it. And I don't think people realize how different these art forms are. I mean, they're so specialized, yet once you dip in, they're completely different. It's like, oh my gosh. Yeah. Oh, that's neat though. Very interesting. So when did you become director of the Cage Trust? Were you the first after he passed, or?
We created the Cage Trust.
You create, okay.
Yeah. So I worked with
Cage from 86 to his death in 92 in one mm-hmm. form or another, either right. with him in place or long distance. But when he died, I was really the person left behind who knew the most about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. I certainly was not expert in his music, but I knew a lot about his current projects. I had worked really closely with him, so I knew the way he thought about things. We mm-hmm. from the get-go, we were really compatible. I often tell people that he didn't like to tell people what to do, and I didn't like to be told what to do.
I like that. Well, but can you...
True. Yeah,
I believe that. Can you speak to like what, you know, he died... I did not ever meet Cage. He passed away right as I was probably 13, 14. And I was in Denver and didn't know who he was. It seems like his death surprised a lot of people. He had so much going on. And at this point, he was beyond world famous. I mean, he was known not necessarily as a composer, but he was very well known. Where was his art going at the end of his life?
There was no plan.
So did he leave a lot of unfinished work?
No, not a lot. Two or three things were left unfinished, but not a lot. You know, he was always interested in the next thing. So both mm-hmm. he and Cunningham were less interested in, Merce was less interested in repertory, except as a means to a commission to make a new thing. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? It was something they could present in order to finance the making of a new work. And really, it was the case with Cage too. So I don't think that John ever really gave much thought to what people think about now. You know, it seems like composers now think about starting up centers for themselves or for their work or trusts or mm-hmm. I'm not sure that Cage ever gave any of that any thought. The closest he came to answer your question is that he was in conversation for quite a while with the Soccer Foundation about his music manuscript being acquired by them when mm-hmm. he was still alive, which he would have then given the proceeds of that to Cunningham for the dance company, because as they like to say, the dance company ate money for breakfast because it was so expensive to run a company. That didn't happen. It ended up at the New York Public Library. Mm-hmm. But basically, Cage left everything to Merce. Mm-hmm. And it was really left to Merce to figure out what we were doing, what was he going to do? And, you know, as I've written in a couple of places, he was in the middle of grieving. He was also embarking on his 40th anniversary of his dance company. So that year was upon him, 1993. Mm-hmm. So he needed help. So it was really left behind were Merce, me, and the executor of John's estate, Bennett Grutman, who mm-hmm. turned out to be a great friend over the years. He's assisted the Cage Trust tirelessly. Close, close friend of Merce Cunningham. But it was really the three of us to try to figure out what to do. Hmm. And I'm sort of fond of saying that, and it's really true that when Cage died, he left, but other people weren't done with him.
Right.
And he had always been the greatest point of access to his work. He was in the phone book. You know, you could call him up and say, I have to teach a class on something next week. And he'd say, oh, why don't you come over now? I'll make us lunch. He did. He was like that. So it left a really big void, a big hole in other people's lives. He also had all of his manuscripts in the loft that he and Merce shared together. So mm-hmm. materials were there. So I found myself in the really demanding position of having to provide for a lot of people that were trying to finish films, finish art exhibitions, writing books, middle of doctoral dissertations, of giving people access, those very same things that John would have himself had he lived. Merce was touring. But the other things, I mean, when I said I knew the most about a lot of things, I'm talking about I knew what the cat ate for dinner. I knew where the keys were. You know, Merce trusted me with the loft when he wasn't around. So I just knew how the bathtub worked. you know, the quirks of the apartment. I just knew a lot of things.
You knew John Cage, the person.
Very well.
This isn't John Cage, the performer, the provocateur. This is where do we eat lunch today? Or what can I cook?
And By the way, he cooked lunch every day. We never went out to lunch. Never.
No. You know, as I was preparing for us last time, and then today I was pulling out my books, and I pulled out Confronting Silence, Takamitsu's lectures, or one volume of his lectures. I reread him writing about Cage and hiking in the mountains of Hawaii, and how Cage is finding mushrooms and delivering them to the museums, and how the museum's annoyed with him. And it's just, you see this human aspect of him. And I think, and maybe that's why the success of the trust is there, is that it isn't about, here's my ego, because I don't feel, even though Cage was human, I don't feel it's just about, you know, celebrating his ego. It's look at all these different aspects. I had a couple of years ago, I got to speak with Margaret Roeder in New York, the gallery she has, which has some Cage stuff in it. And that's an area that I didn't, as a musician, look into until much later. Honestly, it was when I started doing the cover art of my album. I was like, maybe I can use a piece of Cage's artwork and figure out a way to do that. And I was overwhelmed with all that he has done. How do you, as the Cage Trust, how do you divide? Can you divide? I mean, he talks about everything is one. There is no tomorrow or past. It's all from the same place. But can you separate his work? Do you, when you're presenting it to people, do you talk about Cage, the visual artist, versus Cage, the writer, versus Cage, the composer? Do you divide him, or do you just say, here's John Cage?
I don't think that I divide him at all. I think, you know, I'd have to think about that a little more deeply. But no, I mean, there were principles that he lived by, you know, derived in large part from his study of Zen and mm-hmm. the adoption of chance operations and all that that brought to him as a human being and a creative artist. And those were all brought to the work. It didn't depend on the medium. It didn't depend on the materials. It was kind of all of a piece. So I don't think I do.
So, I know with a lot of his paintings, or not paintings, kind of like the burnt paper ones, he's definitely applying chance. There's some beautiful videos, by the way, listeners. Go on YouTube, type in John Cage burnt paintings, and you can see him using chance operations in these aspects. And the joy and the surprise you see in his eyes with the creation is just, it's really wonderful. Did you ever talk to him about pieces in his past? Did he ever go, you know, I'd like to rewrite in a landscape, or I don't like that period of my past? Or did he just not even, was it tomorrow what he was thinking about?
Right. Those moments were rare, but like Music of Changes, mm-hmm. it bothered him. I mean, throughout his life, it bothered him.
Really?
Yes, because it was so much telling someone else what to do. Oh. You know, it was minutely dictating to the performer what they were supposed to do. I think he saw it in some level as a kind of fascist expression or something.
Well, was he aware of what was going on in the public, in the non-music world? Like, let's say, I know we've talked a little bit about his politics or lack of or dislike of, but was he aware when Hendrix existed and died? Was he, the Vietnam War, did any of this get in, or in the, you met him in the 80s, Reagan and all of this was...
Right. He stayed away from current events. He stayed away from politics.
What about pop music? The Beatles?
No. Somebody asked him a question from Life magazine. How did he, Cage, view the Beatles? What was their importance? And his answer, which is published, is something like, he sees their importance in the world of revolution. So it wasn't a musical question for him. It was, who were these people and how did they work?
Hmm.
I always remember, do you know the artist Bill Anastasi?
No, I don't.
Bill Anastasi was, we were at some benefit for Cunningham, and Bill Anastasi was a great lover of opera
And he was also a record collector. John used to give him all of his records because John didn't like records. So he would give them to Bill. But I remember Bill sitting at this table. We were all having a drink at this benefit. And Bill was going on and on about how much he loved Wagner, and he couldn't help himself how much he loved Wagner. And John was just quiet, and he sat there staring at Bill, and he finally said, "We need to get you a musicologist."
Oh, I'm definitely going to have to use that one. That's very nice.
He didn't really have a lot of, I mean, there are stories I could tell you, Aaron, that would take probably more time than you've got left, about his awakening to the idea of
things like crack babies.
Mm. Or the day he found out that Jesse Jackson was Black. These were surprises to him. I remember when there was a lot of sorrow around crack babies, when that mm-hmm. became known to him. And he wasn't much good for anything else the rest of the day. He was extremely contemplative, very forlorn. And I had to reconcile that for myself, because here was this man who I held as my supreme mentor in all things in the world. I looked up to him so much. And I thought, here's my supreme mentor who knows so little about current events. You know, how do mm-hmm. I reconcile that? And I realized really that day that the fact of the matter is that he had to self-protect because he was extremely sensitive yeah. to things like that. And he was probably the most emotional person I'd ever met. When his cat got loose and was never to be seen again, he was useless for a week. He was putting signs all over the neighborhood, you know, "Help me find my cat." Yeah. He was very touching, very, very sensitive soul.
I'm very happy he didn't live during the time of Twitter. I mean,
Oh my God. Yeah. I don't know how he would have coped.
Well, if he's anything like me, I just block a lot yeah. as much as I can. And my wife still tells me it still affects me too much. And I think the artist as a creator, we have to be sensitive to what's around us, but we also have to be very careful about that, because it can really destroy the inside and control the daily life. It can take us over. I know too many artists, and especially in the last few years, who've had serious health issues because of the news and the world around us. It's not that we can ignore it. I don't think we can ignore it, but we do have to control it. I mean, I kind of miss the three channels and news at 9 or 10, you know. Now it's all the time, if we let that happen.
We have a beautiful recording in the archives here of Cage's, I think it was his first public reading of Overpopulation and Art at mm-hmm. Stanford University. It's a really political piece. You can read it. It's in a book called Composed in America, all about yeah. the people who delivered papers at the symposium. But this one particular thing that I wanted to say, and then we should probably wrap it up. I was going to say that Cage got through with all of this, and he didn't feel well that day, as I recall. He had a cold sore. He had dealt with a cold. And he finished, and this woman stood up. He entertained questions from the audience. Someone stood up and said, "Yes, but it's all well and good that you have this positive outlook and, you know, and you find such humor and, you know, junk mail and you blah, blah, blah," whatever, she said. But she said, "What about," and she rattled off a whole list of terrible things going on in the world, genocide, and what about this and what about that. And John just, you could see him, I won't say crumble, that's a little too dramatic, but it was in that direction. Then he said something, "Well, I've just tried to put something positive forward." And he stood up and he sort of walked off the stage. The rest of the audience, thankfully, applauded beyond applause. You know, everybody felt so shocked that right. that had happened, that this person had done that.
Well, it's interesting because he's always considered, I shouldn't say he's always, the stereotype is that he, you know, the music in the hallway, you know, the noise is music. Everything could be music. And yet there's, reading his lectures or seeing his lectures, seeing him talk about his music, there's this kind of sacredness to sound and that it's all around us and this great respect. And I think it, his point of view gets twisted of he didn't have respect for the concert hall, when in regards, he actually had great respect for sound and the creation of it and how we go about that.
Yeah.
And I think that that sense of joy of creation, that's what I pick up. And I don't know, I feel bad when people miss that aspect. And maybe I shouldn't, but I do.
No, I think, you know, to just amplify that a little bit, that he took the transformative capability of music deadly serious. You know, that he felt that his work was in transforming the world, not in improving, you know, but rather to wake people up to the wondrousness that life is through music.
Mm-hmm.
And he took that very seriously. So when people didn't play his music, if they didn't take it seriously enough, or if they took it too seriously,
right,
bothered him. It bothered. Mm-hmm. He wanted them to play it just right. You know.
Yes. Just let it be. That's it. Can you tell us what's the best way for people to find out about the Cage Trust? Is there a website?
Oh sure. JohnCage.org is our website.
JohnCage.org.
That's right, JohnCage.org, and we're perpetually working on it. But there's a lot of data there. There's a lot of information, including my little blog, Coon's blog, is there, which I haven't written one in a long time. We've taken to, you know, tweets.
Well, lastly, and this is a question for all of us who love his music and are always confronted with this question, what do you tell people who try to understand Cage, don't, or just need to get a toehold into his music? And is there something that you recommend they listen to first?
No. But I do say, you know, that Cage wrote a lot of music, a lot of different kinds of music. And so if I get a sense from someone of the kind of music that they like, then I might steer them. But, you know, my take on this is that, you know, the world has a couple of different kinds of people with regard to music. And that is, you know, that some people enjoy things that they understand, and some people enjoy things that they don't understand, you know? And in order to approach Cage in all of his splendor, you have to like to learn things that you don't understand. You know, mm-hmm. It's new. People say you don't like Beethoven, you don't like Haydn, you don't like. And I say it's not that I don't like them. Liking has nothing to do with it. Those are. I get that. I know what that is. But with contemporary music in general, Cage included, the draw is that I don't understand it. So I want to know what's being said here. What's going on in my generation, in my piece are talking.
Right.
You know, music to me is like a kind of language. And, you know, so with Cage, you have to approach this with a kind of curiosity about what is this guy doing? What is he saying? And there's mm-hmm. so many things he was doing and saying. It's endlessly fascinating.
Last question. What piece or pieces do you think need to be heard more, like just neglected? Is there a piece that you just love that you're like, hey guys, over here, check this out? You don't have to say a recording. I don't want to put you on the spot, but is there a piece, you could say live versus recording, but because everyone's stuck inside, why don't we choose a piece that recording, and you can't say In a Landscape, because we know that is a gorgeous piece. It's amazing. And the guitar version is wonderful.
Your guitar version. There are more guitar versions than you know of out there.
I believe it.
There are too many. There are just too many. Litany for the Whale, the antiphonal vocal piece, I think is exquisite. And that's, you know, little known, little understood. What else do I just think is exquisite? String Quartet in Four Parts. That's a work that anybody who thinks they hate John Cage needs to listen to String Quartet in Four Parts. I just love all of Cage's music. And I love all of Cage's music because I explore it. Not that I know it all now, but when I come upon something I don't really know, I look at it and I contextualize it. And then I look at what he did. What was he doing in this? And I'm so enchanted with the process by which he truly was one of the most experimental people I've ever met in my life. He was always looking for the thing that he hadn't done before. What could he do differently in this piece? And it's always so wonderful. It's always so surprising and so natural. You know, it was a beautiful solution to what he felt was not a problem, but a challenge. You know?
Yeah.
So I love everything that he does, everything.
So what should we listen to as a final going out piece then?
I don't know. Can we make it a surprise?
I guess we can. Oh, we could roll the dice. I mean, we can always see what happens.
I could give you a gamut of possibilities.
Oh.
And then, because we need a gamut, you can't just roll the dice.
No.
We'll figure it out.
I only got through like 6 of my like 25 questions, so we may have to do this again. But it is such a pleasure, and thank you for letting me learn about the John Cage Trust, yourself, and more about John Cage. It's so exciting. Well, that's it. That's all I can say.
My pleasure, Aaron. I'll see you again.
Thank you.
Okay.
Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too. Aaron has kindly offered to let me choose what we'll listen to today. And after much deliberation, I've selected an excerpt from Cage's Misostic lecture, Overpopulation and Art. This was one of the very last of Cage's writings, and he gave its first public reading in January of 1992 at Stanford University within the context of an interdisciplinary conference entitled Here Comes Everybody, the Music, Poetry, and Art of John Cage. At the close of his reading, during a brief Q&A, Cage was admonished by someone in the audience for not tackling the larger problems of our global life. An optimist at heart, born with what he called a sunny disposition, Cage was speechless. Another audience member asked whether he would consider a nomination for president. He was visibly horrified by that thought, and the expression on his face made everyone laugh. In the end, Cage left the stage to resounding applause. I chose this piece because of the brief conversation Aaron and I had today on the subject of Cage's knowledge of, or even interest in, the current events of the world around him. As most Cage enthusiasts know, Cage didn't really express political ideas in his music, or certainly not in the way or to the extent that several of his colleagues did. I'm thinking here of Christian Wolff as one example, or Frederick Jevsky. In part, this was because Cage was averse to the projection of fixed ideas and feelings in his compositions. But it is also true that he wasn't terribly aware of or interested in most present-day issues, thinking of them as more or less transitional aberrations, usually having to do with perceived imbalances of power. And further, he was far more interested in constructive responses to problems than critical ones, which he felt were unnecessary diversions. After all, he was a vocal proponent of the ideas of Buckminster Fuller. As he once put it, "Don't like what you see? Make something in response that you do." And as he puts it in Overpopulation and Art, forecasting the eventualities of a changed world, he envisions that upon learning that the Earth's population has ceased to vote, the politicians had simply left. He suggests that they'd all gone to the moon, which also made the audience laugh. We see overt expression of whatever cognizance Cage did have of current societal issues in very few places, his late life, Overpopulation and Art being one. But for more sustained and thorough coverage, take a look at his 8-part diary, How to Improve the World, You'll Only Make Matters Worse, which spans the years 1965 to 1992. I'll be doing a program soon for All Things Cage with Lisa Pearson, principal of Siglio Press, along with her husband, Richard Kraft, who, with Joe Beale, was one of the two editors, indeed creators, of the first complete edition of Cage's amazing chance operation determined masterpiece. As Siglio describes it, Diary is a repository of observations,
anecdotes, proclivities, obsessions, jokes, and Cohen-like stories that collectively register Cage's assessment of the times in which he lived, as well as his often uncanny portents about the world we live in now. Diary is a complex reflection of Cage's own particular sensibilities as a thinker and citizen of the world, illuminating his social and political awareness, as well as his idealism and sense of humor. For the moment, however, let's listen to something of what Cage had to say as a thinker and citizen of the world in the last year of his life, in the following excerpt from Overpopulation and Art. The excerpt we're about to hear is taken from the recording of the original live performance Cage gave at Stanford University, held in the archives of the John Cage Trust. You can read Cage's text in the proceedings that were published of the Stanford Conference in a book entitled John Cage Composed in America, edited by Marjorie Perloff and Charles Junkerman, published by the University of Chicago Press in 1994. There is no audio-only recording, but you can find a DVD of a realization made by Mode Records in 2004, wherein Cage's spoken performance of the work is combined with his Ryoanji for voices and percussion, performed by the virtuosic American mezzo-soprano Isabel Gans and the late American percussionist Michael Pugliese. This is Mode 130, titled From Zero, Four Films on John Cage by Frank Schaeffer and Andrew Culver. The video of Overpopulation and Art was shot at two locations where Cage had lived, the Sixth Avenue loft in Manhattan that he shared with Merce Cunningham in the last decade or so of his life, and at Stony Point, New York, where Cage lived through much of the 1950s.
What are some of the various eventualities in a changed society? No government, keeping education in first place, keeping it, that is, for you to give to yourself, increase of unemployment until we are all self-employed, self-taught, self-governed, a way not just to say anarchy, but to do it. Forget the politicians, they are on the moon. When they saw we were no longer voting, they left. Not bothering with money, preferring credit. Credit's electronic. No person need be without it. But who'll do all the work? Those who do will have pleasure seeing their work actually carried out. Robots making robots. We have the next war mapped out for us to make the world safe for poverty, violation of laws made to protect the rich, while there's still government, pass laws based on the needs of the poor, give them shelter, squatting privileges, change the economic structure of society, out of profit and ownership into use. The police walled up the doors and windows. The house is again not used. And the people are still homeless. Mayor said, evict the squat. The police did it brutally. A house was empty. We restored it, filled space with life, concerts, discussions, people's kitchen, libraries. Nobody gets money for her or his work. A non-profit basis, changes of behavior, discussions about sex, overcoming repressive structures, having no need for art, pleased with what I see, pleased with what I hear, surrounded by multiplicity. He said he could imagine a world without art and that it wasn't bad. Artlessness. The sound of traffic, an instance of silence. The sound of traffic, the sound of traffic, an instance of silence. Phone rings, reviving practice of Christianity. split the stick. Split the stick, and there is Jesus walking on the walking, on the writing, on the water. On the water as though nothing happened. The snow, the white animal asleep, safely asleep in the tree. No traces left. Reviving practice, whether meditation or non-meditation. Pleased or displeased, won't burn. The metal ones won't burn. Is a, is the, is of, is emptiness fullness, practicality, all creation, endless interpenetration, whispered truths. The necessity to find new forms of living, new forms of living together, to stop the estrangement between us, to overcome the patriarchal thinking, the authoritarian structures, and the coldness, human not-togetherness. The necessity to develop a culture that consciously opposes the ruling culture, a culture which we create, we determine, which overcomes the passive consumer's attitudes, and which is not ruled by profiteering. Aesthetic spirit is as though visibility would not help, as though everything that is generally understood must stop. Only what one person alone understands helps all of us. How? What is not understood, a mystery, is now necessary. Something we don't, of which we can't make head or tail. A music of variations without repetitions. An introduction to pleasure that has no need for proof or ideas or feelings. Goal without goal. And what did I hear or see? I can't be sure. It was as if there was nothing on which to depend, as if there was nothing but in the presence of. Nikša Glego wrote from Zagreb to say, the ugly Yugoslavian war is not between people. It has been brought about by that part of government and army that's concerned with Serbian power. Let our friends and all others know the truth. This is not ethnic, nor civil war, nor different ways of thinking. This is an imperialist political aggression. It's all happening in the heart of Europe at the end of the 20th century, possibly bringing about the total disappearance of Croatian state and people. What did you hear? The Pentagon giving up on the radio? Soldiers not to be paid? Just discharged, 700,000, a great boon for unemployment. Do you think we'll finally see unemployment's what we've been working toward? Unemployment's self-employment. At last, we may be doing what we, the human race, could be doing, all of us. As he said, Suzuki said, there seems to be a tendency toward the good.